Resource Subcommittee of the Joint Ways and Means to order and open the public hearing on HB 5017, the Oregon Office of Energy. Will staff present the bill? Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, you have quite a few materials in front of you. There are some handouts from LFO, paper clipped together, and I'll go through those in a few minutes. You have a black binder that looks like this. That is the agency's presentation, which it will be presenting to you after my opening remarks. And then you have a handout from Budget and Management Division, and staff from BAM will be going through this handout after the agency's presentation. So if you'd like to turn your attention to the LFO handouts, I'll briefly go through this information, some of which will probably be a duplication of what you're going to hear later on, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. Attached or included in the packet that is a printout of some slides that present the agency's mission and purpose on the first page, and if you flip that over, you'll see a pie chart of the agency's budget. And the one thing that I'd like to point out to you in regards to its budget is that it has no general fund support, so it's entirely other funds and federal funds in this budget. And then that last slide gives you some of the agency's budget drivers, which I'm sure will be covered in more detail in the agency's presentation, so I won't go over those. But this kind of gives you a snapshot of the agency's mission, purpose, budget, and then budget drivers. And then the other attachment is the more detailed analysis that LFO presents in its of the governor's budget. And again, I won't go over that in detail, but it talks more about the two budget units within the overall budget, the operations program and then the loan programs, and gives you some information on the revenue sources and relationships, budget environment, and then detail of what's in the governor's budget.
So could you explain why the general fund is dropped to zero?
Mr. Chair, I'll do that in conjunction with the next item on this list for you, on budget notes. In the agency's budget report for Senate Bill 5515 from last regular session, and that was the budget bill for the agency from last session, there was a budget note that required the agency to report to the emergency board on an annual basis on the progress that OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, has been making in meeting its financial liabilities and the goals of its business plan. And this was primarily because in the early 90s, OMSI had procured a loan from the Office of Energy for construction on its new museum, and it ran into some financial difficulties. And starting with the 1997 session, I believe, the legislature appropriated general fund in support of OMSI to help it make payments on the loan to the Office of Energy. And there was an appropriation that session and another one in the 99 session, and then yet another one in the 2001 session. And it's slowly kind of been ratcheted down to try to get OMSI to kind of stand on its own financial feet. And so what you see in this detailed analysis for general fund is kind of that phase out of the support from the state to the Office of Energy for OMSI's loan payments. And so the governor's budget does not have general fund support in it for OMSI for 2003-05. So that's why it's zero at this point. And the agency did, as directed by the budget note, report to the emergency board, and the emergency board did allocate the two special purpose one special purpose appropriation in two separate pieces to the Office of Energy. And then item number four pertains to audit reports, and there were no unusual audits of this agency. They were pretty typical for the small-scale energy loan program and then also as part of the overall comprehensive annual financial report for the state of Oregon. And for both those audits, there were no significant findings for the agency. And then I've also provided for you an executive summary from a report that's required to be presented to the Legislative Assembly jointly by the Office of Energy and the Public Utility Commission on the public purpose charge spending that's provided for in Senate Bill 1149. And the report was due on January 1st, 2003. And again, I've provided a copy of the executive summary for you. And if you'd like the full report, we can also get that for you. And there are no fee adjustments, no fee increases being requested in this budget. And then for the last two items on that list, significant policy or oversight issues considered by the emergency board or interim committees, I've just referred you back to number three, which is the budget note for OMSI. And then the last item, relevant issues, trends, or special challenges, I would just direct your attention to the agency's budget drivers on the attached handout and also the issue regarding OMSI's continued need for financial support, but again, not provided for in the governor's budget. So that's my brief overview of the agency's budget.
Thank you, Sharon. Any questions? If not, would you like to present the department's testimony?
Thank you, Senator. Good afternoon, Senator, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney. I'm director of the Office of Energy. And I'd like to also introduce Bruce Westerberg, who's the administrator of our Central Services Division, Garlene Logan, our fiscal manager, and Dinah Enright, our communications manager. The three of them worked long and hard hours to put together the budget package you have before you. I'd like to give a brief overview, about 15 minutes, of what we do, including budget highlights, and kind of walk you through portions of this notebook, and then we can come back to any of these issues you'd like and want to ask me questions as we're going along. First, what we do and what our mission is. I think Sue's presentation captured it well. Our charge is to promote the efficient use of energy and development of sustainable resources, especially renewable resources, to try to assure that there's a basic supply of energy at an affordable price to Oregonians. How we do that is through a number of ways. Federal funding and state incentives like our low-interest loan program to work with schools, businesses, and local governments, and with individuals in areas that the utilities don't work with them on, such as energy-efficient appliances, to try to save energy and develop renewable resources, such as solar, wind, and biomass. We are also responsible for doing the technical review for siting large energy facilities. And we provide staff assistance to the Energy Facility Siting Council, which is a seven-person citizens panel that actually makes the decisions on whether siting applications meet the standards required by law for approval. We're also responsible for regulation of radioactive waste in Oregon. That involves principally three things. One is cleanup of contaminated sites in the state. Two is transportation of radioactive materials through the state. And three, representing the state's interests on the biggest radioactive threat to Oregon, which is not in Oregon. It's the Hanford site in the state of Washington. And I'll talk about all of these more in a little more detail. Let me first turn to energy supply, and, especially the electricity situation from 2001, and that had significant impacts also on our budget request here today. In 2000 and 2001, I think you all recall that we were in a severe electric power crisis, both in terms of a shortage of power, and the price of power had reached extraordinarily high levels on the wholesale market and was causing catastrophic impacts on our economy. The legislature passed a number of important bills to respond to that. Two in particular to expedite the siting of large energy facilities. It's That was House Bill 3788 and Senate Bill 843, and two bills to emphasize energy savings, Senate Bill 520 and Senate Bill 521. And combined with other bills like House Bill 3633, which delayed the restructuring law from going into effect till after we got through the winter of 2001, these bills had a significant impact on our energy supply situation. First, on energy siting, in the previous decade, in the mid to late 1990s, our siting council had approved nine power plants totaling 1,900 megawatts, and those power plants all came online within the last 5 years. But clearly we needed more energy both in Oregon and in the region. And as a result of the legislation you passed last session, our siting council approved, since the legislature adjourned, 11 more power plants totaling another 2,100 megawatts. Over 200 of those megawatts are already operating. We have another 300 megawatts should be coming online soon. There are applications pending for an additional 17 power plants for over another 4,000 megawatts. And not all those power plants may go forward, but clearly the process of siting energy facilities and the number of applicants willing to come into the state to site power plants has increased, I think, directly as a result of that legislation. And on pages 2 and 3 of this notebook, we have more details of the energy facilities, including a listing on page 3 of each facility and where their status is in terms of approval and actual operation and the applications pending. We saw similar impacts on energy conservation and renewable resources. Senate Bills 520 and 521 extended this residential energy tax credit and made changes in the business energy tax credit to make that program more effective, as well as our small-scale energy loan program.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
You were talking about those tax credits, and mindful of the fact that we are hearing nothing but bad news about budget numbers and forecasts for May and March. Could you talk a little bit about how much those tax credits have incentivized certain behaviors and how serious it would be to lose those?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson. Let me address that. I think these two tax credit programs are extremely effective, and the changes you made in 2001 had a dramatic impact. Let me give you some specific examples. In 2001 and 2002, we had investments by individuals in energy-efficient appliances exceeded $12 million each of those 2 years. We had 25,000 consumers in 2002 take advantage of the program. That was double the amount 3 years previously. And these are appliances that are have to exceed federal standards by 25%. So these are what we call premium efficient appliances. They're not your average appliance. They save a substantial amount of energy. On the business side, we saw in each of the last 2 years business investments of nearly $100 million each year in energy savings and energy technologies and industrial processes to be more efficient. We had over 1,000 projects this last year, and again, this level was double what it had been previously for the last 2 years.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Let's go back and talk about the appliance piece of it, because if I'm shopping for an appliance, I have a personal interest in buying something that is the most cost effective. I'm assuming that, and I'm making these numbers up, so correct me if I've strayed too far from the truth, but let's say I go out and buy a washer and a dryer, and I get a $100 rebate on the washer and dryer. Is there evidence that that $100 matters that much to consumers at a time when we're balancing perhaps that incentive against keeping an old lady in a nursing home? I'm just trying to get the sense from you as an expert about whether or not that level of incentive is something that in extreme budget times we could pass on for a while. Pass on like do without for a while.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we recently had Oregon State University do an analysis for us of both programs. And the evidence they found was that both programs really do, especially in the appliance area, we've seen a shift and retailers have told us that anecdotally, that people are buying the more expensive, more energy efficient appliances. And there's three types that qualify: the dishwasher, the washing machine, and the refrigerator. Those are the energy efficient appliances. And the impacts really have affected the consumer choice and the decisions they would make. And I realize it's very difficult weighing you have to do, and I can't argue that energy conservation is more important than any of the other things you have to weigh. But clearly, in terms of the energy supply situation, these programs made a big difference. We were able to get industrial cogeneration online in a matter of months. It was at each site 5 to 10 megawatts during the crisis, that compared to a power plant that, even if you give somebody a site certificate today, will take 1 to 2 years to build before you get that power online. So getting this power has been, through savings and through renewable resources, has been important. And I think not only from a power supply situation, but from a price situation. We can't control the wholesale power price markets or the other commodities like natural gas and oil. But through these investments, consumers are better able to withstand the rate shocks that occur by using their energy more efficiently.
Thank you.
So I guess in summary, with all these changes, we're in a better supply situation than we were 2 years ago, both in the region and in the entire West, as California and Washington and the other states have brought on more power plants as well. But we're not entirely out of the woods yet. Our snowpack, while it's better than it was 2 years ago, isn't as high as we'd like. It's about two-thirds of normal. Wholesale price situation is better than it was, certainly. We don't have rates that are 10, in some cases 20 times normal anymore, although BPA recently announced just this last week another 15% rate increase on the wholesale level, and that's going to affect retail prices. So I think the need to conserve continues to be there to help our citizens and our businesses and our local governments, our schools, to be able to withstand rate increases when they occur. We've also been looking at, with the Attorney General's Office, the causes of those market problems from 2 years ago. And with the PUC, we worked with the Attorney General's Office to reach a settlement with one of the wholesale sellers, a company called Williams Company, which, while they admitted no wrong, agreed to pay the state $15 million. And that will come in through the Attorney General's Office for general restitutionary purposes. And there's another five or six cases that we're actively investigating that we hope will lead to additional settlements as well, which will help make up for some of the damage that was done during that time.
Mike, is there any work through your department or through other federal or state programs that are working on alternative sources of energy, fuel cells,
yes,
kinds of things to... particularly when we're having low water years, and to kind of level this thing out?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and pages 4 and 5 of our handout, especially page 5, talks about our renewable resources and our alternative fuels we're looking at. And our state incentive programs, our loan and our business and residential tax credit, those are sources that... things like fuel cells qualify for, alternative fuels like compressed natural gas and hydrogen, biomass fuels qualify for. We look for federal R&D money when we can for demonstration projects. And recently, with Boise Cascade, succeeded in obtaining a $500,000 grant from the federal government for a plywood mill in southern Oregon that will be using new energy-efficient technology for reusing more of the wood that has traditionally been wood waste. So we look for opportunities like that.
I guess maybe another way of approaching this. We put a tremendous amount of effort in conservation.
I look through your budget, we're still doing a good effort there. But my guess is, and my perception is, that we've probably picked up most of the easy gains we're going to make from conservation, although we need to continue the program. I'm not suggesting that we not do that. But it seems to me we're getting close to the situation now where we've got to, as you've also alluded to, develop new sources of energy and maybe other types of energy is where we're really going to have to push the next 10 years or so if we're going to avoid another situation like we had 2 years ago. I guess where I'm coming from a little bit is I look at the mission and look at the budget, trying to think if we're appropriately putting the efforts where to prepare us for the future.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is a good question, and we do try to, you know, we keep reanalyzing our efforts as we go along. On renewable resources, most of our energy loan activity, in terms of the volume and the size of loans, has actually been for energy generation projects rather than energy conservation, even though the number of projects there have been more energy conservation. We've done things like small hydroelectric facilities, cogeneration using wood waste and wood chips, some wind and photovoltaics, and on large scale level, we have sited three energy facilities now that are wind. Over 100 megawatts each, and we've been approached by developers for projects that would be as large as 500 megawatts in the Sherman County and Gillum County area, where the resource is quite promising. So the technology has changed quite a bit in some areas, and there's some promising developments, and we're trying to structure our programs to encourage those further and take advantage of them for Oregonians where those are viable.
Along those lines, and in particular in regards to siting, what is the time frame? I'm sure it varies on a different source of energy between the application for a site and when that site is ready to start construction. And I guess I'm thinking of not only your aspect of that decision, but also zoning and maybe even financial.
If a project comes into our siting council for approval, under Oregon law, we have a centralized process so that actually zoning decisions, any land use, any local decisions, any decisions that other state agencies would normally make have to be made by the siting council through our siting process. And state law generally provided that the review must take no more than 1 year once an application is complete. Now, when Senate Bill 843 and House Bill 3788 were passed, they provided for expediting certain energy facilities, especially renewable resources and large natural gas projects that are sited at existing either energy facility sites or existing industrial facilities, where by doing that you reduce the environmental impact of new construction, and you've already had industrial development and infrastructure there. And with those changes, we estimate we can do the reviews now in less than 7 months. So that's our goal.
Any other questions? Proceed.
Let me turn then to a little bit more on radioactive waste. As I mentioned before, we have three responsibilities. First is cleanup of sites in Oregon. And in Oregon, there are two sites that are currently active. One is the Trojan Nuclear Plant, which the plant has been closed since 1993, but is undergoing decommissioning. Most of the major components inside of the containment building, which is the circular building you see from the highway, have been removed and have been transported to a low-level disposal site out of state. The spent fuel, which is the other remaining radioactive material, is over the next year will be removed from the spent fuel pool and put into dry cask storage. And that will have less impact, less economic impact, and ultimately is in a safer form. And it's in a form that if the federal repository in Yucca Mountain is ever opened, then the spent fuel could be shipped there. The rest of the cleanup of Trojan is going successfully. We're also working on two...
May I have a question?
Where is it going temporarily?
Well, temporarily it will stay on site, but it will be in a building on site. In dry cask storage.
Okay.
It'll be... dry cask storage is considered safer than spent fuel pool. And it's quite a bit less expensive for the utility as well.
Now, we're on site. I mean, you can say, maybe you can't.
Well, it's one of the building. There's a building there that is set up for the dry cask storage.
So it'll be above ground.
Yes, it'll be above ground. Yes. There are also two abandoned uranium mines in Lake County that we're working with the federal government and the Kerr-McGee Company, which is the responsible party for the cleanup of those mines. Prior sites have included a site in Albany and a site outside the city of Lakeview. We also are involved in shipment of radioactive materials. We see virtually every shipment into and out of Hanford goes through Oregon for anywhere from 200 to 400 miles, depending on its route. And so shipments of radioactive materials are very important. We had 200 last year. In some years, we've had as many as 1,000. And depending on the activity at Hanford, those levels could occur again. We work with ODOT inspectors. We train their inspectors at the way stations at the borders to be able to inspect the shippers for radioactive material compliance with regulations. We work with the federal government on what how these shipments should occur, such as to avoid bad weather and which routes to work to take. And we also work with emergency responders in the event there is an accident so that they know whether it's safe to approach a truck that's gone off the road, for example, carrying radioactive materials. We trained over 300 emergency responders throughout the state in 2001 and over 450 last year.
Have you had any... several questions. First of all, have you had any incidents of truck wrecks or spillage or any concerns? And how have they done in their inspections? Have you had any noncompliance or any concerns in the inspections?
Mr. Chairman, we have had some noncompliance. I can get you more details. Occasionally there have been trucks with bad brakes. I don't recall any serious incidents in the last few years, but I'm sure there have been some violations. I know there was some years ago a very significant shipment of higher-level waste that it was coming from somewhere in the Midwest, and they started in the middle of the winter, and we told them to wait a few months, and they got to the Oregon border after going through a series of blizzards, and the brakes were out, and we wouldn't let them pass. They had to get the truck repaired before it would come through Oregon. We've had a couple of shipments, probably once a year or so, we'll have a truck just go off the road from icy conditions. My recollection is there's been no release of radioactive materials, but the importance of the training and the coordination with the emergency responders and the shippers, I think back to one example some years ago where we had a situation like that, truck went off the road, and the local police came up to investigate, and a couple people got out of the truck with submachine guns and wouldn't let them approach. It was a weapon shipment of some type, and that's the type of coordination we need to make sure it doesn't happen so that our emergency responders can safely approach the vehicles and know whether they need special shielding or not. And we have not had an incident like that again. That occurred about 10 years ago.
Do you have safety records of truck travel or
yes, and we
barge travel or rail travel or what?
Yes, for that we We work with the federal government on certifying the shippers who's authorized to ship certain materials, and we have information on the scheduling now and what materials are coming, and it's for all three modes, the three modes you mentioned, truck, rail, and barge. And we'd provide, be glad to provide more details on any of those if you'd like. We mentioned on briefly that on interest of time, I'll pass over the discussion of Hanford, other than to that's on some details on page six. Other than to mention, I was in the chairman's office last week when we got an emergency call and an incident up there about radioactive release, and it turned out that the event, the monitors went off falsely, but it was false alarm. But that event occurred at noon. I think I got the call in your office after 4. There was about a 3-hour delay in notifying our people as well as the state of Washington, so we're investigating what happened. We should have been notified a lot sooner in case there had been a problem. On page 7, we have our affirmative action report, and it's an area that we continue to try to work to improve, but one thing that I wanted to point out, I'm very proud of this year, is that the Governor's Affirmative Action Office ranked us in the area of hiring workers with disabilities as one of the top 5 agencies in government. We continue to need to improve in the other categories. We're very, very pleased with that, and we'll continue to try to work to improve all these areas. Let me turn to budget summary and talk about our budget. That's on page 8. There's an overview there. As Sue mentioned, we have no general fund. We also have no bills that we're introducing this time because of the legislation that you introduced last session that we think is working well and has had a significant impact on our agency in terms of workload. And to reflect that, we added a middle column this time in the budget that shows our 0103 projected expenditures, because there were some impacts of that legislation after passage of our budget. Couple of highlights. We do expect and we're requesting limitation for an increase in federal funds based on two things. One is increase in energy conservation measures, partly related to Homeland Security initiatives from the federal government, and also an increase in Hanford funding, our work on our technical oversight work on Hanford. Senator Wyden and Senator Smith have earmarked $1 million a year for us in the Senate Appropriations Bill. That would nearly double our funding and allow us to do some work that we've had to curtail previously, such as independent monitoring of the Columbia River, work using the OSU radiation lab, and some other things that we think are important. So those are the reasons for the increase in federal funds. On our other funds, our regulatory fees, siting and other fees, are down about $200,000 from our projected actuals for 0103. And that's about a 3% reduction of fees. And that's primarily because of we anticipate a reduction in applications for large energy facilities, even though it's still an increase over where we've been. It won't be as big an increase as we had this current biennium in response to the energy crisis. Sue mentioned that in the context of no general fund that there's no request of funding for OMSI, and that is correct. OMSI is looking at other alternatives in the way of restructuring its loan that we're exploring with them. But they are not seeking general fund, and the governor's office is not requesting general fund for OMSI. We do have
Mr. Chair, if I might. In the discussions that we had, you indicated that they would more than likely be requesting some lottery bond funding to tide them over.
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan. One of the options we're actively exploring is currently the bonds that underlie the loan that they have with us are general obligation bonds. And OMSI is looking at placing those bonds with lottery bonds, which are revenue bonds, and that the the lottery revenues would then pay those bonds off. Our bonds would be retired. The state's general obligation liability would be reduced. And OMSI's obligation on the loan would be eliminated as well. So there are some advantages of that. There are also some issues of what is the state's bond capability.
I guess, Representative, where you're going is that we look at lottery and general fund as same money. Is that right?
Well, and I remember grappling with this issue in the last session when we were trying to figure out what to do, and there are some huge downsides to having OMSI default in that the state of Oregon ends up owning a science education facility in downtown Portland. And my other recollection is that OMSI is working and was working very, very diligently to try to get the money to pay off the debt that they have, but that they keep running into these circumstances that are beyond their control that really impact their ability to raise money. September 11th being one, and just the general state of the economy in Oregon being the second one. But certainly lottery bonds, you know, in terms of their usefulness for economic development would, I think, be a reasonable thing to consider for this.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a program option package, and it's described on page 13 of 14 of your notebook. We are requesting six new positions. Five of those positions were added limited duration during the interim as a result of the increased workload from the energy crisis and the energy legislation that was passed. Involving siting, energy conservation, and the Senate Bill 1149 legislation started for those programs. This is the first ask for new positions in more than a decade, so it's not a request we undertake lightly, and we recognize this is not a time normally of expanding state government or state agency, but we think this is a unique circumstance that justifies it. And I've got a history of our prior employment levels on page 23, if you'd like to look back to. It's been flat since 1995. Before that, there were some major reductions made. So this has been, I'd say, the first time in over 10 years we've requested new positions.
Mike, could you speak to the reasoning or the urgency of requesting permanent positions?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, what we're asking for at this point is request for approval for the positions in the new biennium. Some of these positions, I defer to Adam on, DAS has agreed should be permanent and some should be a limited duration, and I think we're fine with his recommendations on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of the positions, five of them already exist as limited duration positions, and with the work with Senate Bill 1149, some of that workload is just likely to be continued as long as those obligations are there.
My guess is that's not a critical decision if we wanted to make them on a limited duration.
But we would be fine either way. I guess what is critical to us is permission to have the positions for the next biennium, however you characterize them. Finally, let me mention a couple of things that we do try to, and while we don't have any general fund, we recognize that our funding ultimately comes from either ratepayers or taxpayers in some way, and we do try to be good stewards. Our loan program, for example, we have refunded bonds, which is like refinancing your mortgage when the interest rates go down. As a result of that, we'll be able to save our loan customers $10 million in payments and higher interest rates that we've otherwise had to make. We also try to give good customer service. Our residential tax credit, we get 100 to 150 applications a day, and we have a turnaround of a week in terms of a response, letting people know they qualify. And That notification used to come by letter. We now have set up a system with a special printer and a postcard mailing that will save us $6,000 a year in annual savings there. Our website forms were downloaded 54,000 times this last year. That if we had sent those out by mailing, it would have cost us $18,000 that we've been able to avoid. We also we try to run our programs throughout the state, rural Oregon, urban Oregon, whether it's served by publicly owned utilities, investor-owned utilities. We try to serve as many people as we can, and that involves sending our people out on the road a lot. And we had 83,000 miles, driving miles last year, and we had no citizen complaints on the driving, no citations, and no accidents. So I'm very proud of our folks in that regard. And we received the state controller's Gold Star certificate for accounting, for our method of accounting and our ability to do our accounting meeting their standards this year. And finally, let me add, just recently we were able to hire as temporaries for clerical work two of the people who had to be laid off by the state police who were doing clerical work there. So we're pleased we could help out, and we're continuing to look for ways that we can help other state agencies when they have to go through layoffs.
Mike, all of your suppliers, I would assume, throughout the state, including the co-ops and the consumer-owned, pay into the, what is the name of that fund, the Energy Supplier Assessment Fund.
Yes, sir.
Do you have a formula where the monies they pay in on a percentage basis go back to their communities, or how do you make sure that you do get equal?
Mr. Chairman, there's no specific formula to go back dollar for dollar. We actually try to use that assessment is about 10%, between 10 and 15% of our budget, depending on the funding that comes in. So we try to leverage then the federal funds that we're able to receive and other funds. Often that assessment is needed, say, as a match. But then we can use those funds throughout the state, and we I think I provided to each of you a list of some projects in your counties that we've been able to do, and we have that in every county, and we really have worked hard to make sure that every part of Oregon, small schools, big schools, small businesses, local governments are able to take advantage of our programs. And
are you able to break out the amount of money that comes from different regions of the state or counties of the state, and how much?
We can do that.
Back,
I don't know.
We
haven't really done that on a conscious basis. We can do that, and we'd be glad to do that for you or for individual utilities if they'd like us to try to estimate that.
I think both ways might be good, because in some cases we have more than one supplier.
Mm-hmm.
Your mission and your budget indicates that you have emphasis on environmental issues. I would guess that most of those environmental issues are more in the urban I-5 corridor than they would be out in rural Oregon. And how do you?
Mr. Chairman, I think the environmental standards come in a couple of ways. In terms of siting large energy facilities, our standards, there are standards that have to be met to assure that there's not a significant impact on the environment. And I think those standards from our siting council's work on approving facilities has proved that they're workable. They're flexible, but they're fair, and they're fair to the local interests. In some cases, we have local opposition, but in two recent cases, most recent in Columbia County, there was no opposition to the power plant siting. And we try to deal with, when there is opposition, deal with it and address the concerns to the extent possible, or have the applicant address them, and then the siting council determines whether they're made or not. Otherwise, generally, renewable resources, while they may have some impacts, generally have less environmental impact than fossil fuels. So to the extent that we're promoting renewable resources, energy conservation, we think there's a secondary benefit to the environment, even though our primary purpose is to assure stable supply of power and give people a a way of dealing with rate increases and rate shocks when they occur.
Specifically, your BPA funding you get, how are those funds allocated?
The BPA, Bonneville Power. BPA funding is currently a relatively small portion. I think virtually everything we get from BPA is for energy conservation. Is that correct? So that
is that in your SEU?
That's it's a pretty small portion. At one time, they were the BPA funds was a substantial portion of our budget, but in the late 80s and early 90s, they started making reductions. And I think our portion of BPA funding, let me just take a moment, Mr. Chair. I think I have a detailed table here. Probably less than $1 million a biennium. I
believe. Budget page 122, Mike, is that covered?
Actually, that $300,000 was a estimate that didn't occur, and we currently aren't projecting any money for 2003-2005. No funding from Bonneville for conservation.
Why is that?
Well, they have substantially cut back their expenditures on energy conservation just as part of their cost cutting. The publicly owned utilities that are served by Bonneville continue to offer conservation services. And Bonneville may be providing some assistance to them. I'm not sure the exact amount, and they could I could get that information from them. But in terms of direct funding the state and local governments, for example, for activities, that has pretty well been eliminated. Chairman, I think that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to go into any areas you'd like for any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, if I just might suggest one thing, since the subcommittee is to ratify each agency's performance measures, that perhaps there should be at least a small discussion on their performance measures.
Performance measures and vacancies and outcomes and all that stuff.
Chairman, our discussion of our performance measures and the Oregon benchmarks are based on start on page 16 and go on page 17. And then there's a couple of charts that follow explaining the benchmarks. Benchmarks on energy efficiency and renewable resources in terms of the amount of savings and energy from those sources. We have a carbon dioxide emission reduction goal, project diversity, and by that's a goal on trying to assure that our program incentives don't just, I guess, provide incentives for energy savings that's traditional, but encourage new technologies, new ways of doing things. We also have a benchmark on nuclear preparedness in terms of emergency response drills and how we're graded by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and a goal on Hanford cleanup in terms of the milestones where seeing whether the federal government succeeds in the legal mandates it's required to do each year. And those are...
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Sure.
You have your fourth benchmark has to do with States and counties within proximity to nuclear power plants?
Yes.
You have no data, no targets. Why is that a benchmark?
Let me ask Bruce Lincoln. And this does involve one case. This is the commercial power plant at the Hanford Nuclear Center. We have two counties that are involved that are within the 50-mile emergency planning radius, and so they participate with us on those drills. The zeros there indicate the amount of times that they're not prepared. So we're trying a zero mark is a good mark in that case. If I follow your question correctly.
Oh, I see. Okay, so this is kind of a reverse performance.
It is. Right.
Well, you know, it's kind of related. I'm on page 16.
Kind of ahead of me a little bit here. As I look down through these bullet points, I've made notations off the side. Some of them definitely apply to your agency. But I'm concerned that most of these you have no authority within your agency that I'm aware of to make any impact, and so kind of struggling as why.
Then
why
I
would
feel
be
better because I was there about 2 minutes ago saying exactly the same thing, and staff helped me.
Mr. Chairman, could you respond to that? I mean, as I go down through, there's one, two, maybe three.
Mr. Chairman,
would apply to your department, and the rest of them, I'm going, they should be ODOT or DEQ or OBSELF or something.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're certainly not the lead agency involved, and most of the benchmarks do not explicitly address energy. With the Progress Board, in fact, we, as a result of suggestions they made, because of the fact that we didn't have direct responsibility, we changed the benchmarks for performance measures for energy efficiency, renewable resources, and for environmental protection. We limited the carbon dioxide emission to power plant siting where there's direct impact and we have direct involvement. And on energy efficiency and renewable resources, that was rephrased to focus totally on energy savings rather than energy as a percent of dollars spent. So, but I agree with your comments. The other benchmarks apply to us secondarily. We're trying to make them work. Is I guess the mode we're in.
I have a question.
Attorney Morgan.
This is related to the Senate Bill 1149 funds, and the bottom three bullet points there, it's pretty clear that Oregon Housing and Community Services has jurisdiction over the last two categories of funds, and the ESDs through the Department of Ed have jurisdiction over the third one from the bottom. But the Energy Trust of Oregon has jurisdiction over two of them, and who are they accountable to?
What are you referring to?
This executive summary.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, it's the one that I passed out with the LFO handouts. Executive summary from the report that's required to be presented to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I can address that if you'd like. The Energy Trust is a nonprofit organization that was established under the direction of the Public Utility Commission. So ultimately, they are accountable to the Public Utility Commission. Senate Bill 1149, when it was passed, established the public purpose charge. One of the things the law said was the commission could establish a nonprofit. It didn't require it, but it gave permissive language as an option, and versus either, I suppose the other options would have been to have utilities continue to run most of their programs like they had done previously, or perhaps provide funding through state agencies or local agencies or whatever. The trust is generally responsible back to the PUC. This particular report, the law also requires that the PUC and ourselves, my agency jointly, select an independent contractor to evaluate how they're spending the money. All the agencies involved are spending the money each year, the public purpose charge, which the Energy Trust has about two-thirds of the funding. And then, like you pointed out, the individual schools through their education service districts and the Department of Housing for low-income weatherization and low-income housing have the remainder of the funds. And I can provide the entire report to all of you if you'd like. This is just a one-page summary of it.
Have they been through a period of time yet that would, well, I guess my question is there any kind of a report on oversight on how these two pockets of money were spent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Sam Morgan. The funding, have a moment here. I can give you some totals. The trust has been in operation since March 1st. This report covers the first 6 months. They wanted to have a report completed for the legislature. And during that time, about $21 million has been collected under that public service or purpose charge, and $12 million has been spent for all the categories. That amount, the Energy Trust received about $15 million of the $21 million and spent about $10 of the $12 million. And the other agencies are working with the remainder of the money. So there was a startup period, so in some respects I think it's they've gotten more money out than I thought they would for the first 6 months.
Mike, I'm a little confused on your figures, and you can explain this to me. In the executive summary, it talks about $21.8 million from PG and Pacific Corp.
Right.
Now, they disperse that money within their own organizations?
No, the money is collected from them. Under the restructuring law, the public purpose charge only applies to the two large investor-owned utilities in the state. Publicly owned utilities do not have to participate in restructuring and deregulation. They can if they wish, but none have elected to do so. And so the public purpose charge has collected the money from PG and Pacific's customers, and then of that $21 million, $15 million has gone to the Energy Trust set up by the Public Utility Commission. The remaining six has gone to schools through their education service districts and Department of Housing. And that money, as the trust is operating over a full year, both the trust money and the non-trust money will increase probably to a grand total of about $40 million a year, would be my guess.
Okay. More questions? Okay. Did you have more to present on the performance measures and outcomes?
No, Mr. Chairman, unless you'd like me to explain these in more detail, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. We do have a list of our vacancies also, and that's okay. On page 36. Of those, one of them involves our Hanford program, emergency response and training. We just had a person leave recently. That's the Natural Resource Specialist 4. And we're, I think, right, is that the position? We're actively looking to fill that position right now.
Is that the one that you're contracting back presently?
No, that's one that we need to fill. A person just left recently, take another position, and it, involves our Hanford emergency response and transportation issues.
And which position was that?
Should be number seven.
Okay, I'm sorry, number seven. Program Tech 2. I'm sorry.
Number 4 is Tom Meehan.
Oh, okay. That's number 7.
Your position number 4, the natural resource position, have you contracted with the ODF&W or
not
agencies that have biologists that might have expertise on?
Mr. Chairman, what we usually do on that is we will do some contracting with the other state agencies where we need their assistance, but mostly we have so we can manage the workload. We use a private consulting firm to kind of deal with the big bulge of applications when they come in, so we don't have to hire people for a short period of time and lay them off and when the application process slows down. And we've worked with primarily Pacific Energy Systems as our prime contractor. And they've provided a lot of service over the last 2 years for us.
And I guess just to be real blunt, my concern there is so many people in the industry, in the fisheries industry, have different agendas. And I could see where you could be going different directions with maybe some of our state agencies. Has that been an issue for you at all?
Mr. Chairman, it has come up. It was a concern that was raised last session in the legislation that was passed, and some things that were, I think, meant to address it. One was the stricter time limits, and two, the agency, if we need assistance in a given area, let's say geology, and Department of Geology simply doesn't have the staff to respond quickly. The law was amended to make clear that we can contract with outside agency or without outside entities instead of the state agency. And that's true whether it's Fish and Wildlife or Water Resources or Geology or anybody else. In practice, we haven't had much of a problem with that, but it was a concern the industry they wanted addressed in the bill. What I think has helped us is our standards, our siting standards are very clear-cut. We don't have a NEPA standard that's a weighing and balancing. And by that I mean if the energy facility meets the standards, it gets its license. If it doesn't meet the standards, it doesn't get its license. In some states, you can meet the standards, but there's still a weighing and balancing that says on balance, even though it's meets these standards, we think the environmental impacts are too great, you're not going to get your license. Or vice versa, we think even though it doesn't meet some of these standards that we need the power so much that you can get your license regardless of the impacts. Oregon's system, I think, is very straightforward. You meet these standards, you get your license. And I think that minimizes it, certainly reduces the opportunity sort of for at least unclear, uncertainty and manipulation and ulterior agendas. I mean, we try to run this as a very straightforward process, and we may not always be successful to please either developers or people who have reservations about a given development, but I think it is a straightforward process.
I guess begs the question, what is the description of the position? Or is it to help applicants meet the standards of the application, or is it to there's two ways to approach on a job description?
Right. We try to be, I guess, first try to be fair to all sides, but so to some extent the staff is neutral in terms of their role generally, but when we get an application, we work with the applicant. If the application clearly has deficiencies, don't go through the whole process and then turn them down. We tell them go back and address these issues so that your application can be considered. And we do that, and we do make a recommendation to the Siting Council then as to whether we think the application does meet those standards. So we do take a position. We also work, if there's opposition, with the opponents to ask the applicant to, you know, if there are issues that can be addressed. In some cases, it's clearly, I don't want this thing built, or I don't want it, if it's a pipeline, I don't want it built through my yard, I want it built through my neighbor. Somebody's going to have to make a decision there. But to the extent that issues can be addressed, and often they can be, and the applicants are often willing to work with the community to try to address those issues, our process can facilitate that, and we try to do that where we can.
I'm going to ask a question a little different. For the position number four, what is that job description?
Well, it's a reviewer of applications for energy facilities. And we can get you the detailed description.
To see that they meet the environmental standards.
Yes. But it's not just environmental. They're also safety and financial, but all the standards.
Well, this individual was a fish biologist, I believe.
He had a PhD in biology, but he
fish and wildlife.
Our staff had developed expertise in a number of areas there. And he reviewed the entire applications. Okay. So the physician doesn't have to be a fish biologist, if that's what you're asking, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Okay. Anything else to present?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
One thing, did you have priorities, and I don't know if this applies where you're all other funds and federal funds, but
we did make
have budget issues as we get through the coming biennium?
We did make a list, Mr. Chairman. It's the next to last marker in your book called Priority List. And we did do reductions based first on sort of working from the bottom of the page, House Bill 3182 reductions, which are 10% reductions, and then worked our way back up. And I guess none of these do involve general fund, but our basis was, you know, our top priority was public safety. Second were the statutory mandates we have on the agencies, such as handling tax credits and low-interest loans. Third is our other regulatory responsibilities, and I think you could certainly go back and forth between those two categories as to which is more important. And we did it based on an overall agency mission rather than funding sources, and then the other two categories are, while we think valuable and important, I guess would be lower if we had to make those reductions.
I would guess that a lot of your funds are dedicated as well, aren't they?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The reduction in the fund, you have to direct it straight to the dedicated.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Chances.
Okay. Well, thank you very
one,
much.
One question here at the end.
Krieger, come alive.
So I just saw these full-time employees, and we've been talking, Mr. Chair, about PERS. Even though they're dedicated funds, someday they retire and become PERS recipients.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So if you hire anybody now, they'd be under Tier 2?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Senator Morgan.
The other funds that are in the category of the statutory incentives, if those incentives didn't exist, those would be monies that would go to the general fund?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morgan, no, these are... in the case of these three programs, these are revenues that come in. Well, the first two, the business tax credit and the small scale energy loan program, the applicants pay for the cost of review. So if there were no tax credit or small scale energy loan program, there's simply no revenue there because that's they're paying for the cost of review.
Oh, okay. So that's a credit on the cost of reviewing their application. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's not the actual tax credit general fund impact. That's it.
So they would, if that program didn't exist, the fees would simply be higher?
Fees would not be there at all. There would be no fee there. because we wouldn't be doing that function.
Okay. Okay. And is the same thing for the other ones?
For in general, yes. If we did not do energy siting, if we didn't do line 3A, for example, we would not be collecting revenues to do that function.
Okay, so if you got rid of all these programs, it wouldn't have a beneficial impact on the general fund at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, I believe that's correct, except to the extent that the tax credits reduce revenues coming in to the state. And they're not in our budget because it's the way the budget is constructed. They don't flow through our budget.
Now I'm confused.
What this is the cost of our administering the tax credit program. The tax credit, because taxpayers get additional refunds back through the tax credit, means they're paying less taxes to the state, so there is a general fund impact there of the program itself.
Okay.
In that sense, there could be a general fund impact. But not on the portions that are in our budget.
Yes, before Representative Morgan gets rid of it, could you maybe next time we're all here together get me some information on the residential tax credit program? I know I've had it in the past. I just
be glad to. Glad to, Senator.
Sign up for it? Maybe. They're offering it for.
Well, I think it is a valid question, though, because especially this year, we need to know what impact those credits have.
Yeah.
Every time I ask for questions, there are questions. Miraculous.
It's a great agency, Mr. Chair. They want a really tight ship.
Right.
We can't get at their money anyway. But they do a terrific job. So
Ben, are we ready for you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Adam Torgerson with the Budget Management Division. If you turn to the presentation that we typically hand out, the second page shows the historical context for the Office of Energy. And you can see that overall the office has just under a 7% increase from the fifth special session, but that also takes into account some other fund non-limited increases. If you turn to page 3, they have the breakdown of the office, and you can see that, you know, a large majority of the activity is from non-limited energy loan type programs. If turn to page 4, it's just a brief breakdown showing, again, a few bullet points that the governor's budget does not include general fund for OMSI. The governor's going to look after the March forecast and see what the situation for lottery bonds is as well, and discuss that issue at that time when he comes out with some revised recommendations. It anticipates refunding some bonds on the call date to get a lower interest rate and add several positions, which we'll discuss a little bit as we get back there. If you turn to page 5, it shows the proportion of the two programs. You can see that the energy loan program, just from strictly an expenditure point of view, is a large part of the agency. Flip over to page 6, and you can see how it breaks down amongst the budgeted spending categories, with about 11.7% personal services, and you can see the large special payment again there. Flip to page 7. You see the agency went to the emergency board twice for OMSI special purpose appropriation. They're essential packages. They basically they phase out the $491,000 appropriation or allocation at the emergency board. The second one wouldn't be built into the base of the budget, so there's no need to phase it out. The inflation and price list adjustments, right down there, about $500,000, most of that in inflation for professional services, state government service charges, and special payments. And page 8 is the package, the single package the agency has with positions. They are revising the second program, Tech 2 down to work in the Conservation Division, and we'll be providing more information on that as we get along here. It's related to workload for Senate Bill 1149. And if you flip to the last page, it's a technical adjustment. The governor's budget didn't include the necessary reduction for cost of living increases for salary range 38 and above employees. So that's that technical adjustment, in addition to any other personnel actions that legislative, fiscal, and budget management are working together to resolve.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Any questions about it? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper.
And we'll probably be back here tomorrow at 1:30.
Okay.
Because we've been delayed, and we do. I'm not going to join you.
Okay.
But maybe some of the questions that Senator Dukes asked, you can give us a little more light on. And anything else? I don't really have anything else that we need additional information. Do you, Sue?
Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to call Doug Riggs. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify today? We'll be here tomorrow as well, so.
Chairman, I appreciate the time. I won't take much of your time. I know I've been through a lot so far. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs, and I'm here today not as a lobbyist. When you guys usually see me, it's for a particular issue that a client is working on. But I'm here today as a citizen and a member of a public group that has regular and very positive contact with Mike's department. For those of you who don't know, I'm the founder of a group called the Hanford Information Network. We're switching our name, coming up with the Pacific Rivers Protection League. We've been around for about 5 years, and we're a voluntary citizen-based organization that focuses mainly on Hanford cleanup, although we're going to be moving into some other areas, including Portland Harbor cleanup as well. We're here today briefly because our partner, and I mean that sincerely, our partner, the Office of Energy, it was up before you for the budget to be considered. And I wanted to give you a couple comments about our experience in particular. I've been around government now for about 15 years, both at the federal level and here at the state level, and I have to say that this office operates differently than any other that I've been accustomed to dealing with in the past. We typically have kind of an arm's length relationship with government agencies that we've dealt with in the past. They do their job, they run their programs, and they close the door at 5 o'clock and they're out the door. The people at the office, on the other hand, in the areas that we've dealt with, which has been mainly Hanford cleanup, have taken a real personal interest in seeing that Hanford is cleaned up and Oregon is protected. And it's not just Mike who has this particular attitude. There are 6 or 7 people at the department, at the office, that have dealt with Hanford issues with us over the last several years. And in each and every case, they've put in the extra mile to be involved in making sure that Oregon is well represented at the table, either here at the state level, at the Northwest level, or at the federal level. Hanford meetings are often long, seldom interesting, and they tend to go on late into the night. Hanford Advisory Board meetings take place on a 3-day period every single month, frequently up in the Tri-Cities, which isn't exactly the Las Vegas or the Versailles of vacation hotspots. Our meetings typically run from 7 o'clock at night until 11:30 at night. Sometimes they're early in the morning on Saturday morning, and they're designed to try to get the public more involved in participating in Hanford issues. And yet, every single one of these meetings, their Office of Energy people who attend the meetings and are committed and work very hard. I just thought I'd give you 2 quick examples of our experience with the department. A number of groups got together about 2 years ago to try to figure out how we get a better educational foundation out on Hanford issues. And one of the options that we had was doing an exhibit at OMSI. The first group of people to volunteer to help us out was Mike's department. And they participated in the advisory group. They were active on the panel that made recommendations about what should and should not be covered. They participated in the grand opening. They have been trying to get schools and other folks to come and see the OMSI exhibit. So it's been a very positive experience.
And the second, our group has a grant from the Department of Ecology to do educational outreach to Washington State high schools. And in the past year, we've been to 41 high schools and talked to about 1,500 kids about Hanford cleanup. The Oregon Office of Energy is running a similar program here in the state, and it's been a good partnership as far as us going to them and sharing material and vice versa. And so two very positive experiences. In conclusion, we're not in the habit of appearing before the Ways and Means Committee and supporting a particular agency's budget, and I doubt you'll see me up here doing it again. But my board had a conference call last week in which we voted unanimously 7-0 to send me here to tell you that our experience with the department, with the office, is very good. And we certainly have a great deal of confidence in Mike and his team, and for that matter, we hope you'll endorse his budget proposal. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Comments? Questions? Yes, Representative Krieger.
Chair, just that we do have DEQ, Division of State Lands, and some others coming up that you may want to comment on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I think I've said enough.
Maybe a question or comment, but I know you brought up the 11 o'clock at night and Saturday morning meetings as a compliment to the department, but I'm wondering, would we get better public participation if we had meetings on those kind of hours?
Well, sometimes we wonder if we'd get better participation by having them during the middle of the day. You know, it tends to be a small group of people who remain concerned and active on Hanford issues, but they're a dedicated group of people.
Actually, seriously, in the past, we have had many meetings, hearings at night and on Saturdays, and had very good turnouts. There is a point to be made there.
Yeah, I just wanted to take this opportunity to make a comment. I agree with everything you said. I was just sitting here trying to figure out how long it was, and then I wished I hadn't figured it out. I did my first Hanford something or other, and I don't even remember what it was called, and Mike was around then, so he may remember, but in 1983, I was a county commissioner. Did them pretty much nonstop until 2 years ago when I finally said, put somebody else in here. But you couldn't ask for a more dedicated staff and easy to work with. I have watched, I don't know how many citizens come through, people who honestly cared, people who came through the door scared to death that Hanford was going to kill them tomorrow, and watched them learn the process and be included in absolutely everything. I don't care if we took a tour of Hanford or we went over at a high-level meeting or what the heck we did. The Department of Energy, Office of Energy, we flipped them back and forth. But they always would argue the case for having the citizens there and for working with them. And all the public hearings, because you have to understand, Oregon was cut out by the federal government. They don't think that all this sort of stuff affects us, and so we've had to create our own from the ground up. And the fact that we're acknowledged at all is because of the folks at Energy. They've done a great job with this little bitty agency.
We better quit this, or they're going to want more money.
Well, as long as it's other funds, we're okay, right?
Somebody pays the other funds, too.
No, that's true.
Well, thank you, Doug. With that, we'll close the public hearing, and for the audience as well as the committee, again, we do not start till 1:30 tomorrow.